You're listening to a track called Pure from the album Synthetic, Season 2, by the award-winning Halifax-based musician-composer Rich O'Coyne, my guest today. Rich is an artist with seemingly endless creative energy and vision. His latest project is an ambitious quadruple album called Synthetic, A Synth Odyssey, and it's being released over 2 years. It features some of the world's most rare, historic, and highly sought-after electronic instruments. Rich's music is life-affirming, genre-bending, and infectious. His multimedia live shows have become almost legendary for being these experiential, sing-along, sweat-soaked dance extravaganzas. FYI, all the music in this episode, aside from the theme song, of course, is by Rich. But please check out the show notes if you're interested in a particular track or you want to learn more about him in general. And a quick reminder before we start the show, this podcast is ad-free and completely independent. Therefore, we rely on your kind contributions by way of donations to keep us going. If you'd like to donate, just go to musicbuddy.ca/donate, and it's really simple from there. It also really helps us out if you can talk up the show on social media, share links, or comment and rate on your podcast app. Thanks for being here. I'm Jane Gowan, and this is Music Buddy.
It's all feeling. It's all connection, that human stuff. So tell me where you're coming from,
where you're coming from.
'Cause I got time and the night is young.
Hello.
Hello.
I like that we both have Rhodes keyboards in the corner of our screen.
We do. That's so true.
Yeah. Yeah, nice work. 73 there?
Yeah, it's a 73. What's yours?
I have the rare 54. They didn't make a ton of them. It's just like, it's about the same size as a Whirly. So it's like a little slightly lighter and less backbreaking.
Exactly. Yeah, these are so heavy.
Oh my God. I used to tour with one of those when I was in my late teens. And it was like the bane of my existence because I was so into Air at the time and they had a Rhodes. And I was like, I'm only playing Rhodes.
You have to be in your teens or 20s to be able to schlep these around.
Yeah.
And not
yeah.
hurt yourself.
Totally. Yeah.
Especially once the end of the night comes and people are a little
bit more. Oh, yeah. You lose that adrenaline and then suddenly all the full weight of the Rhodes hits your lower back.
Exactly. But they sure sound good.
Oh, they sound amazing. So great.
It's so worth it. So, hey, I wanted to first make sure that I give a shout out to Lori Brown.
Nice.
For introducing me to your music. Because she, nice. I listened to her Pondercast podcast. Mm-hmm. And I think she obviously has interviewed you maybe more than once. And you guys have worked together, but mm-hmm. she also was really urging people to go out and check out your music. So I followed her advice and I'm so glad I did.
She's the coolest. She's introduced me to so many rad bands on the Signal over the years.
And she has great set lists playlists that she puts out for Pondercast now too. So that's really cool.
Totally. I mean, I guess I should shout out the more current thing. It's like, go back in time. Listen to her amazing CBC show.
Exactly. And also, thanks to you for granting me permission to use your music in my interview with her.
Nice. Yeah, of course. Anytime.
Congratulations on the ECMA, East Coast Music Award.
Thanks. Thanks so kindly.
For Best Electronic Music Album of the Year.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Third one in a row now.
Is it?
Yeah.
Amazing. This one's for Synthetic, which is your most recent release. Mm-hmm. Synthetic, A Synth Odyssey. And this is for season one of four of them. Well, season one, it's really album one.
Yeah.
Of four epic albums that you're making.
Yeah. I thought I would use TV terminology. I like the season idea.
Yeah, I like that, actually. Mm. And I like the S alliteration, too. Mm-hmm. It's fun to say. That's quite a project that you've embarked upon. I mean, you seem like the kind of person who just wants to keep doing stuff and just not stop doing stuff. So this is an amazing project. So it's four albums, and it's going to have the most synthesizers ever played on an album in the world in history.
Yeah.
Are you applying to the Guinness Book of World Records for that? Is that something you're doing?
I already did. It's approved. I just have to send in all the documentation. But it basically took like 2.5 years just to get it approved from going back and forth, reapplying three times to Guinness Book. So like that whole process, for anyone who's thinking of trying to do a world record, give yourself a couple of years just to get them to say, okay, sure, go for it.
Yeah. To even grant the permission to just go ahead and try.
Yeah, because I think it might be a little easier if you're suggesting attempting an existing record, but if you want to make a case for a new record, it's a long, long, arduous process.
Oh, I see. This is a new record that you're...
Yeah. I don't think anyone before was like, wait, we seem to have a lot of synths on this record. We should apply to Guinness. I really want that stamp.
Synthetic season one has 37 synths on there, right?
Yeah.
All played by you.
Yeah.
Future seasons will have guest appearances.
Yeah.
Many, maybe reaching into the hundreds. I'm not sure how many.
Yeah, hundreds for sure.
So guest appearances by synth enthusiasts who you've found online and who you've, you know, just reached out to and who have sent you in their samples of what they do.
Yeah. So many, 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 many folks. It's great.
That is so cool. This is a fully instrumental album, and your previous album, United States, which was, was that 2018?
It was 2020.
2020.
Mm-hmm. It came out during the pandemic.
Oh yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. So it was very vocal heavy, amazing album, and something you recorded while you were biking across the United States. As if just recording an album isn't enough. You did it biking across the US from LA to New York, writing songs as you went. It's a great album to listen to. It's so much fun, super vocal heavy, a lot of like huge big choruses and super danceable. And Synth Odyssey, Synthetic, is also super catchy, really danceable, but fully instrumental.
Yeah.
So was it fun to go from doing full vocal kind of vibe to just instrumental?
Yeah. With every record, I just, you know, think about the things that were big elements of the current record and then just try and flip them for the next one. So it's a constant oscillation between different elements and temp and like everything from like lyrics in this case to tempos or instrument choices and like the way the concepts and how it's like made and whether I want to make it more on my own or more in studios, and all those kind of things are up for grabs. And so right. I usually just make like a list of like 10 rules that I pin up on my wall in front of me.
Uh-huh.
And then I just try and stick in those confines. And for the specific contrast between United States and synthetic, mm-hmm. Specifically writing lyrics is like the hardest part of music for me.
Right.
And it just takes so much time. I write, you know, 10 versions of a song before it's even like a demo. And then it's just a constant, like I usually pin up my lyrics around the room so I can like look at them and feel annoyed that it's not as good of a line as it could be. And so then I kind of do that over the whole recording process and eventually end up with something that I'm not like cringing over. Because United States was like pretty much front to back vocals, I was like, this might be a good time to finally do that synth record I've always wanted to do. And I know I can make synth music until the cows come home. It's just so relaxing and nice to just make electronic music and especially synth, because it's like so much of it can be done in the confines of this bedroom studio. Whereas anything I have to go over to a studio for is going to slow down the process. As I started making the track list of the songs I wanted to make, it quickly ballooned. And I realized I was like, oh, I'm making a quadruple record. But it's fun because by the end of it, I think I'll have made almost every genre of synth music that I enjoy and like encapsulated them all on one quadruple album together.
Wow, that's incredible. So yeah, you're talking about how synths are kind of a comfort go-to for you. But you grew up, you're a classically trained pianist, right?
Yeah.
And so that must kind of feed into that somehow and help you be a good synth player, I'm assuming.
Oh, I mean, yeah, having a knowledge of classical music, I think, is just such a good way to understand you know, and especially being like a pianist, just visualizing everything on the keyboard is so great. And so yeah, that all led into immediately like feeling comfortable with at least the keyboard part of the synths before I started understanding the knob part of the synths,
right,
which was a longer journey. But I started, I started playing synths like when I was a teenager. I didn't have like an analog one, but I had like a Korg Triton and would play that a bunch. And that was kind of like my first foray into it. And then in college I did, experimental music, recording as like a kind of like minor. And mm-hmm. there we had like a bunch of rare synths, like the ARP 2600s and stuff like that.
Nice.
So that's where I like kind of learned, you know, attack, sustain, decay, release sort of vibes. And yeah.
Right. No, to be clear for people out there who are listening, what we're talking about in this case is the vintage analog synths, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be different from some other kind of synth.
In a way, you
have to give me a crash course.
Yeah. Well, yeah, just the Korg Triton that I learned on, you could adjust all the synth parameters, but you know, you just go through your category box of synths and just, you know, go through programs that were presets that for me as a 16-year-old was just really happy to be like, oh, this one's called expressive lead. And I didn't understand the like you know, what it was doing until you could hit an edit button and then go in and look at, you know, oh, it's, you know, expressive because one of the things is the attack is rolled off a bit. So when right. you hit the note, it doesn't make a percussive sound. It bends into it sort of thing. So
yeah. Or so what the, kind of waveform it's using maybe.
Yeah,
or?
Exactly. Yeah. So like right. really nice, like sine waves and stuff like that, as opposed to having like a harsher square or a triangle yeah. wave.
Right. I mean, what is it? I found that listening to this record, some of those sounds are so comforting. Mm-hmm. And which surprised me because mm-hmm. I don't listen to a lot of electronic music, but they're just like, I'm just thinking about track 3 called Future or yeah. track 5 Return or even yeah. the Space Western.
Yeah.
It's just, I found it really comforting. Like, what is it about that? Is it because of the analog nature of it? Or
I think just the melodies and the those songs like have melodies played on synths that are, yeah, that like on nice like sine wave kind of like non-harsh kind of sounding things. So like it's easy to kind of like pull into those as a way instead of the more like aggressive songs on the record. The interesting thing too about Future versus Return is the lead in Future is all done with like a VST. So like you're just like in the box synthetic synth. You're like right. your fake synth, okay. as opposed to like Return was like played on an actual like Moog synth in real life.
So I'm going to give you a comparison. As Rich was talking about there, the lead part on the track called Future is performed using a VST, which stands for Virtual Studio Technology. And that's basically an audio plug-in software interface that works with your digital audio workspace, aka your DAW. So as Rich calls it, it's your in-the-box synth. Here's a bit of that track to demonstrate how it sounds. Now, here's a sample of the track called Return, which was performed on a Moog synth, in other words, an actual instrument, in real life.
One of the things I've been doing as a general PSA with this record is just saying how impossible this record would have been before this moment in history, because synth music has always had this like inaccessibility, because you need to be around these synths that were either very expensive and rare at the time, and then now are even like, yeah, like, yeah, it's always just been very expensive and difficult to like get access to these synths. So, mm-hmm. so while I did start this record out at the National Music Center in Calgary, probably like one of the best, like they're probably toe in toe with this synth museum in Switzerland. And those two seem to be the largest synth collections in the world. Even with all those synths, I still ended up using some of the things that I demoed in this bedroom because it just had the timbre that it needed to be. And like when I tried to replace it with like another synth, sometimes the analog synths can just take up too much attention and space. And like, so you're like, oh, maybe it is nice that this thing is just a little thinner and a little like, you know, just knucking right in where it needs to be sort of thing. So yeah, Future is a good example of something that I thought was strong enough to be the lead, but it's still not a analog lead. So yeah, kind of really trying to make the point that there's a lot of fans in the synth genre that are diehard analog or bust. And
right.
I think we're at that point that we're in the Pepsi taste challenge of synth, where it's like very hard now to tell the difference between what's emulated and what's real.
So one of your rules wasn't that you had to only use the analog synths. I guess that was...
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I think like shouts out to Archuria, who are not sponsoring this podcast, but they are making some of the nicest affordable synths. So anyone can buy like a synth that would cost $500,000 for $25 and
amazing.
And just like, you know, control it with your MIDI keyboard. And and it's really uncanny how good they've done a job with it.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you, because it made me think of when I was in high school and I'd go to the Vancouver Planetarium, the mm-hmm. H.R. Macmillan Space Center, and mm-hmm. go to see Pink Floyd. I think it was called Skylights.
Wanted to go to that show. I think it ended in the mid-teens, right? I feel like I remember the like they were announcing that it was going to end after like 40 years or something of it, and 30 years, I think. And it had been like on my radar for a while and I just kept missing it. I wasn't planning my tours around being in Vancouver on a weekend where I could catch it, but I like just kept narrowly missing it. And then I think it stopped, but I'm going to look into it right after this and see if it's still somehow miraculously going. It sounds amazing. I've never been to one of those planetarium laser shows, but yeah. That would be totally up my alley. I did go to the planetarium though, and that's where I saw Choir for the first time. And we did Bowie's Space Oddity, which was very fitting.
Oh, that's so great.
I'm a big planetarium, and I'm a big any kind of show or amusement park rides. Like sometimes like I'll ride a ride and kind of like want and see like what's happening. But sometimes I'm like, I'm just going to let it unfold and not try and like understand what's going on. Cause you can be in like a haunted house or something and like kind of see how they're like pulling off an illusion or something like that. But it's also kind of fun to let the smoke and mirrors be magic. I'm going to up it more in the coming years. It's always been like an idea of mine to have like more like kind of like magic in the show. In the early days, it would involve me like exiting the venue in one door and then coming in another, maybe like appearing somewhere that is unexpected in the venue as well, stuff like that. And then one thing I always do is I look online to see if anyone's talking about coming to the show, mm-hmm. and then I write their names. And then I put those people's names into the show. And so then it's someone who's like never had an interaction with me in life. And they're watching the show and then suddenly they're in the show and they're like, how is this possible? And sometimes they'll come up to me after the show and be like, how did that happen? And I just like to be like magic. And they're like, no, but really. And then I'm like, if they ask four times, then I'm like a bridge troll who has to be like, okay,
you have to give
here's
up
how, here's how I did it. Are you happy now? There's no Santa Claus.
Oh, darn.
Also, spoiler alert, there's no Santa Claus.
Yeah. Let's talk about a little bit about your live show.
Mm-hmm.
They're really experiential.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have this amazing parachute that you bring out, like almost kind of lo-fi props in a way, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Party tricks.
But totally, yeah. They used to be from Dollarama, but I retired the Dollarama phase. But still, the parachute is like a really nice, economical way to make a big spectacle that fits in a checked bag.
Are you mostly alone up there, or do you have another musician with you?
Yeah, so I mostly have like a network of 40 musicians at any given time that all live in different cities, and they all can join me based on the economics and the geography of like where the show is. So I'll have like backing bands in Vancouver and Toronto and Montreal and Halifax and New York and Nashville, Los Angeles and Paris, and like especially like all the French guys that play with me really make it so that when I come over to play like mainland Europe, I don't have to fly a full band over from North America, and makes it way, way cheaper. Like I've toured more places in France than I ever thought I would. A lot of like smaller cities that I never kind of envisioned going to. And being there with like the rest of the band all fluent in French like really makes my job easier too, because I have like a bunch of translators and stuff like that. So it's kind of like the troubadour style, like mm-hmm. classic like country western singer-songwriter rolling into town with the side musicians, but mm-hmm. instead of them being unknown people, they're all people that I've previously played shows with and gotten to know and been like, I really like your drumming. Do you want to like join the roster and play some festivals sometime? And so I'm constantly like getting more people in on it. So yeah, there's been probably over the years, there's been a few hundred people that have all played in the band.
Wow.
I should, before I start having foggy memories about it, I should write everyone down, because it would be an interesting list to see everyone who's shared the stage with me.
Oh, definitely. You're sitting in front of a wall of album covers.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Is that a Phoenix album cover back there?
It is right there, yeah. Wolfgang Amadeus Phoenix.
Have you played with those guys?
My Phoenix story is funny. I played a festival with them in France, kind of like their version of Coachella, called Eurockin'. Phoenix was headlining, and I had just met them backstage. I heard that some friends were in the delivery room, and they said that they were listening to Phoenix to kind of like be the music while they induce labor and stuff.
Wow.
And so I got Phoenix to stand with like a sign being like good luck and like kind of like wishing them well sort of thing.
Oh.
And then they played the main stage, and then we were like the side stage right next to them. And it was a life lesson that I have always taken away, being be ready for your show 15 minutes early and not at the show time you think you're going to play. Because uh-huh. they ended early and I was still like setting things up. I just heard the music stop and then I just heard 40,000 people all walking by the stage. And I was like, we need to go on right now. And I'm like, I don't even have like, I haven't changed into my show. Like now I change into my show stuff first. Mm-hmm. So that if someone ever came up to me and was like, hey, Phoenix just stopped, you should go on right now. I'd be like, ready. So yeah, it was funny. It was the most hectic 10 minutes of my life because I was like, we need to start. We are bleeding out people every second that we're not playing. And so I did play with Phoenix, but unfortunately played after them and not before them.
You seem to be someone who's so good at creating, you know, connections and community, and you've got this gift for creating excitement in your fans and obviously in all the people you've played with. You know, you're talking about riding into town as a troubadour and bringing all these people together that the community would already know, like the mm-hmm. people that you're playing to. But you also have that same, you apply that same kind of principle to your fans too, like you were talking about putting the people's names up on the screen who are mm-hmm. going to be coming to the show and creating that kind of magic. I don't know if you still do this, but you let people text you.
Yeah.
And you give out your phone number.
Yeah.
You give out your phone number after your show.
I was doing it like 10 years before all these big pop artists have their like fake text me burner numbers. So like it's become a big thing in like pop music. A lot of like people like, I don't know if Rihanna does it, but like someone like that level. I mean, even our, I joke about it with Dan, friend Dan Mangan's. I got this like, they all have this like text me. And I think Dan might actually like look over those. But for anyone larger, there's no way, you know, these like pop artists, Ed Sheeran or someone is like seeing your text message. But for me, it was just my like, it still is my current number, which I like without any exaggeration, thousands and thousands of people have texted me and have that number. And yet it really shows the fact that people have been really nice. And I've only got like two prank phone calls in 16 years of that number.
Wow.
But yeah, it's been great. Back in the early days, I put it up because I was doing, I was playing a lot of DIY, like house party kind of shows across mm-hmm. North America. And I would like meet everyone at the show and I would just text people my music. And that was the easiest way to communicate. I think the thing that I chose text to rather than like everyone, I remember like going to see like OK Go, came and played Halifax before they blew up. And mm-hmm. I remember the singer went around to every single person in the bar and got them to sign up for their mailing list. And I was like, that guy's going to make it. He's got some hustle. And this was like a show to like, you know, 50 people or something like that. But it always made me feel wary of the mailing list. Like I'm just like collecting data and stuff. So mm-hmm. I liked that the phone number felt very like a mutual vulnerability. In those days, there was no one like using phone numbers to kind of like mine for data, but now mm-hmm. data is mined in every conceivable way. So I was doing that. And then when I played festivals, like the last time I had my phone not on silent, we were playing the Montreal Jazz Fest and the show ended, there was several thousand people there. And I had the phone number being like, text me if you want music. And we just watched my like phone on like vibrate, just like move around the table because of all the texts that were coming in.
Amazing.
But now it's like, there's no point really of me doing it anymore, because if I was like, text me, I'll give you my music, they're like, I already have all your music for free. Right. So like, that's you incredible. Either have a streaming service or you have the internet, and it's all there for free. So,
and do you feel, you know, as someone who's making his living at music, do you feel like giving stuff away for free is going to, it just seems like that's just been a good thing for you. Like if you're giving it away for free text, or if you're giving it away for quote unquote free on Spotify, you know, what are your feelings on that?
Yeah. The main thing was always that, you know, people can find a way to have music if they want. I wanted to eliminate like any sort of guilt if you just wanted it. I think once the streaming had kind of devalued music so that unless you have a physical thing, like music is like worthless, then it was just like kind of have fun with you know, how you spread it around and stuff like that. It's never really been a part of my like income and the way I live. So I never saw that world before. When I talked to older bands who were like bands in the 90s and stuff, they're like, oh, we actually used to make money off our records. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that sounds interesting.
What a concept. So yeah, I mean, how do you mostly find yourself? Because you are selling Synthetic as an LP, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you do have merch. Really cool merch.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting with albums and merch, like there's like just so much work making them, moving them around, shipping them. You kind of almost just do it for fun. It's not real in terms of like real money. The last place that has livable money is sync and ad placement and stuff like that. So that's how I live, is basically my music gets used in Netflix shows and movies and commercials and stuff like that all the time. And I have a publisher that kind of takes care of all that for me.
Oh, that's nice. And you've done some composition too for films like the, what is it? The No Ordinary Man?
No Ordinary Man was the last one. Yeah. So yeah, any director out there listening to this, I would love to work on your film. I'm trying to get it out there more, that I would like to do more, composer work for films. And it's been nice, like over the years, like I've recorded music in most genres, from like folk to heavy electronic music to and that they even let me it took a year, but I got to write six of my songs out for eight of my songs for like a full orchestra that I got to perform with out here during one of the Pop Explosions. So that was fun, like working on those, like getting back to like a classical arrangement and stuff like that, scoring for an orchestra.
It was amazing. How do you have time to do all the things? I was thinking about your videos and how they're just so ambitious. And I mean, they're mini films, really. They're not just, you know, you're not just walking down a street. Well, in some, you know, you might be floating on the ocean or something. I want to know how.
Which even the simple ones like that took weeks of figuring stuff out.
I bet it did. It's incredible. And that's for release, right?
That
one where you're floating in the bay. But the videos for It and Walls, you reenacted classic films and classic music videos respectively. And those were really impressive. And I'm actually wondering, first of all, how do you find the time to do all this stuff? How do you fund these videos? This is a three-parter question. And did you have to get the rights to recreate those scenes in It and Walls?
Okay. So first answer is that... for those two videos, about 100 people worked on each one of those videos.
Wow.
So as many people all kind of figuring things out. So big team effort. And then that's only possible because both of those videos were funded either through Factor for the It one, or we got the MVP video grant for Walls. Mm. So both of them, it's interesting, like so many people are working on it and only the money is really just going to like all the bare essentials. Like no one's like making good money on these. So, So I did try and pick videos that I thought people would be like excited about making too. So like the film one, a lot of people worked on that in a way that I think everyone was like such fans of film that they were like, I'm going to put those extra 8 hours to make your Top Gun helmet look amazing. But I'm not like getting paid properly for that. So, So there's like lots of stuff like that, in those videos, the labor of love. And of course, mm-hmm. like all the, both of those videos were produced by like Shut Up in Color and, my buddy, Jason Levangie and Mark Tetreault. And yeah, so that they like none of the creative team or directors make any money or so yeah, just seeing how far we could spread. I think we had about 15,000 for the It video and 25,000 for the Walls one. The Walls one, it's 10 years later, so you know, things cost more and we were renting the same studio that they made the Lighthouse in, and just after them. So there's still like all this like Lighthouse stuff that they forgot to tear down. Still around. Wow. Yeah. It's a really a big joint effort. Mm-hmm. And those videos just, yeah, wouldn't have been possible without funding. Mm-hmm. And then the last answer is no, you can do anything under parity law.
You can.
So, yeah.
That's a pretty accurate parity,
yeah.
I have to say.
Yeah, it was fun ending a music video as a montage to other music videos with the king of that, ending it with a Weird Al montage, who was the only one. I had all these like private conversations with like Jamiroquai and OK Go and Fatboy Slim, but no one like acknowledged it except for Weird Al, who on with no like, I didn't like be like, hey, could you please retweet this? Like he just cut together a whole thing and was like directed all his fans to like, he made like his own separate post about it, which I thought was so nice and cool of him.
That's amazing. And that's something you've talked about too, is supporting other people. And you really focus on that, and you do that yourself. You talk up other bands, you talk about other artists, you know, you've just done it in this interview too. So you know, you're saying like, let's get people to support each other more online and stuff.
Yeah.
Right? And you were talking about how you were just touring in Japan and how all those bands were supporting each other and stayed for the shows and watched each other. And
if we could import that into North American shows, oh my God, mm-hmm. it would be so amazing. I try and separate the feeling of like when I first got into music and how good it felt when you play those first shows and you only have, you know, 10 friends come out, but you and the other bands are like in it together and you're all supporting each other. And like that feeling feels so good. And then as you play more and more, you realize it's like a business and the other people playing with you, like who even are like excited for the opportunity to open or something, like will like leave. Mm-hmm. As soon as they like don't need to be there and stuff like that. And so then you're just kind of like, oh, that's too bad. Like it feels so nice. Like when it feels like everyone's working on this whole evening as a whole narrative arc together instead of a series of individual episodic moments. Yeah. I love the idea of everyone like kind of being in a community for an evening together. And it was amazing seeing in Japan, we saw so many different types of bands that we played with that really reminds me of how fun it is to play eclectic music nights. And mm-hmm. I think most people like, maybe this will be too like controversial, but most people with good taste like many different genres and don't like limit themselves to being like, I only like this one genre and the rest are dead to me. So like having a night where it's not just all bands that are doing the same thing, I think is like so much more exciting than trying to like make it like a playlist that has all the kind of same stuff.
You play this certain kind of music now, electronic music, dance music, or whatever you want to call it, but you've probably played other styles, and you're from Halifax, where there's mm-hmm. a lot of rock and roll bands that come out of mm-hmm. there, like Sloan and yeah. Joel Plaskett and all those. And you're part of that community, and
yeah.
and your brother's a musician too. And is your sister also a musician?
Yeah, she not anymore, but she, I've always said in interviews that she played serious recorder.
Right.
She played recorder till college and would play like in like broke quartets and stuff like that. And recorders, it's funny, a lot of people's memory is like just, you know, we didn't have it in the Maritimes, but a lot of my like friends in Ontario and other places like had recorders in school. And so yeah. it was kind of this like annoying instrument that it was very piercing. But it's funny, the soprano is such a harsh sound to get wrong. But once you graduate, like when my sister was playing in college, I don't think they would even use the soprano, because you would have like the alto and the tenor and then the bass, those three. Like the alto could like hit high enough pitches that what you'd want from the soprano anyway, and then mm-hmm. and then it's just like much more like woody and, you know, Stairway to Heaven sounding. I did recorder until high school, and it once you graduate away from the soprano, then you actually are like, oh, this is a pretty beautiful instrument and I'm glad I play this. But yeah. The soprano is kind of a weird I think it's an economic choice that. And maybe for kids' kind of tiny little hands, it probably makes sense too.
It was good.
But oh my God, to be an elementary school soprano recorder teacher, oh, that would be
our recorder teacher was, she was very strict.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting at my desk playing my grade 7 recorder test. And
yeah.
I just went blank. It's the first time I'd ever done something like that. And my whole...
Yeah.
I was so nervous that everything went blank.
Oh man, I can imagine. Yeah, I can imagine. It felt like in that era too, there was so many teachers that just gravitated toward this like strict teacher that is like, you're going to play it right and not yeah. the like, you know, use the force kind of style.
Yeah, let's just enjoy music. You play trumpet too, right?
Which I do, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I do too.
Oh, nice, yeah.
Shout out to the trumpets,
yeah.
On this album, was one of your rules that it was synths only, or would
yes.
would you be ever tempted to add like, oh, I just want to add a bit of trumpet there or something?
Oh no, yeah,
no,
harsh no, harsh no. Like your recorder strict level, your recorder teacher level no. Yeah, I'll play trumpet on their future records for some trumpet. Okay.
Good, I look forward
times.
To that.
Yeah.
So right now, I just want to make a shout out to Rich's amazing music videos. They are so much fun to watch, and he stars in a lot of them. So go check them out as soon as you can. I wouldn't be offended if you even just press pause right now and took a quick video break. you're a great actor. And
thanks.
You've got a really good sense of humor on screen, and you're compelling. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's not always you in the videos. You feature lots of other people, really interesting characters. But do you enjoy being on camera?
Yeah. It's a lot of fun. I also want to do more stuff on camera. So if you're a director that wants me to score your film and then also act in it, get at me.
Joe Coyne is your guy.
But yeah, I've done a lot of like short films for like the art school out here just as an actor. And I've been having a lot of fun with friends of mine got me to play like the villain in a sci-fi horror movie. And so I was like in a big alien costume. And that was amazing. It really made me be like, oh, I could really enjoy being like a Darth Vader sort of, you know, you don't even see my face, like, but it's all just like body acting. So I've been enjoying that. And I've been enjoying like when we've been making this space Western movie, a lot of the time I have a visor that obscures my eyes, which is an interesting like thing to use that really makes you comfortable to like inhabit that character more. It just removes half of the work you have to do so that you can be like, yeah, I think my mouth wasn't doing anything stupid. That takes probably good.
Yeah. Well, I've watched the teasers for those. Is the full one is for Space Western?
Coming
There's
soon.
Two teasers.
Coming soon.
No pressure. No pressure, Rich, but I'm pretty excited.
I'm editing it. So it's like, I'm just finding time in between all the other projects. Yeah. I'm trying to make two more music videos this month too, that are and then animated ones coming out in June. So it's really just finding whatever time I can.
Synthetic season 2 comes out on May 19th, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you're embarking on a whole tour. So yeah, I don't know how you're going to find the time to do anything, but that's amazing. You literally just got off the road and now you're back on the road. That's pretty exciting. And I'm going to be seeing your show June 1st in Vancouver. What should I bring any special shoes? Like, what should I do?
Comfortable dance shoes.
Comfortable dance shoes. Okay.
I'm thinking of even going, and I've been doing this show mostly in like Stan Smith's, but I'm like, I might switch to like a really like cushion sole runner because there's so much jumping, and I was like, that might feel really fun to have it be really comfortable.
Yeah, Stan Smith's are great because they're just so classic, and they feel really good and they look good. But there's the Hoka. Have you ever tried the Hoka?
I haven't, no.
It's you're basically walking on a cloud.
Yeah, so something like that, because there's a lot of jumping in the show.
We'll be ready.
Just be hydrated. That's the big thing.
Speaking of staying hydrated, one thing I've learned about Rich is that he's super health-oriented. In fact, he's done 2 North American tours by bicycle. And in order to perform his high-energy live shows, he really needs to be at the top of his fitness game. So I wanted to ask him how he stays healthy on the road. When you're doing a traditional tour by van or car, how do you stay healthy and stay energized, because your shows, you have to put out so much energy in those shows.
Just try and not eat too much junk, and try and fit exercise, like going to like the hotel gym every day.
Oh, you do, eh?
Yeah. If I have time. When we were in Japan, though, hardly any, maybe 2 hotels in the whole month had gyms. So I actually it was a challenging time for my physical health. So now I'm back into working out here. I actually moved the drum set at the foot of my bed for exercise equipment, just to encourage that to happen more while I'm waiting. Yeah. So a lot of the time I have to like render something. So I'll hit something on the computer and have 5 minutes and just pop over there and do a couple things. for years I've treated tour like the same schedule that you apply at home. I've never been like the kind of like rocker party person. I typically used to only drink on the weekends of tour. And so like, if you're touring and playing every night, like you're around people who are partying every night, but you have to be like, no, this is a Tuesday for me.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll have a drink on the weekend, but not tonight. And and so now that's kind of morphed to about like maybe 7 years ago or 6 years ago, I just stopped drinking at shows, but I would have like maybe like one at the end of the night as a like while I was packing up sort of thing. But I love being completely sober for all my sets, because it gives me this feeling of like really aware of everything, almost like a going back to my lifeguarding days.
Oh,
in
yeah.
a way that like when I have a drink, it makes me just a little looser with like reacting to things, and not just reacting to something like a musical note, but like how something makes me feel. You can let it go faster if I think you're sober than the milliseconds. We're talking about milliseconds, but yeah, like the feelings and emotions that flow through you. You can work through everything faster with a clear head and not a foggy one. So I only really now have more than one drink, like the last night of tour sort of thing. That really helps me not feel destroyed.
Yeah, well, yeah, and you've talked about playing to crowds where everyone's kind of got that glazed vibe going on.
Yes, yeah, everyone. You read one of those articles on it. Yeah, the glaze, I'm always fighting the glaze. So I'm trying to like, trying to plan my shows so that they're like on like earlier. Mm. Like there's like a witching hour for the glaze that I try and like, try and get on stage before midnight. That's a goal.
Yeah.
And then a lot of shows, like the bigger cities, it's easy because my set time is like 9 or 9:30.
Mm-hmm.
But like when I'm playing, like especially out on the East Coast here, the bars want you to go on at like 1 a.m. and I'm actively like fighting against that all the time.
I mean, I guess you spend a lot of time on the computer. Do you also try to make efforts to get out into the outside world and get away from your computer for your mental health and physical?
Yeah, I think it's very important and kind of like part of why I live out here as opposed to out in other larger cities that kind of have a bit more like hustle oriented mindset in my peers and friends there, and necessity wise, because of how much more rent is. I've been in this apartment now for 16 years.
Wow. Amazing.
So, and it's only gone up $100 in 16 years. So I've like kind of rent controlled my own existence, which has been nice.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
You must have so, a wonderful landlord.
I do. Yeah. He lives in the building too. So it's been nice to like have his support over the years. So I kind of like just being out here because I'm a 10-minute bike ride from like a large empty park and lake and a 20-minute drive to surf in the ocean. And I go surfing as much as I can. And I think that's a big part of like my quality of life. The computer, and especially like social media, I look at like a burning building that I need to go in because there's a lot of cats to save, but I'll go in and I'll get a cat and I'll pick it up and then I'll just like get out without stopping to scroll too much. And just all the fumes.
Yeah. Good idea. That's take some discipline. That's very self-discipline.
But you gotta go get the cats.
Gotta get the cats for sure. Do you think you'll ever do another tour on bike?
I do. I've been trying to make it happen so if you're listening to this in New Zealand and you want me to come score your film, star in your film and bike across your country, and you're also a booking agent,
Rich O'Coin is your man.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've been for about 5 years trying to get down to bike across New Zealand, but it is proving difficult to find the contacts to get the show bookings that I need to make that happen.
All right. Well, yeah. So we've got to put the word out.
Yeah. I don't think I'll be able to do it in 2024, but I'm hoping 2025, my last year of this phase of my life, I'm hoping to start that year off with the bike tour.
Well, I love that you have always something on the horizon. Your creative output's incredible, and I'm super impressed. And getting to know your music and your videos and everything that you do has been super inspiring to me. So thank you for that.
Oh, thanks. My pleasure.
So good luck with starting off the tour. And I hope it goes really well. And I hope everyone goes out and gets a ticket, and go get your tickets in advance, right? Don't wait till the door.
Yeah.
That's torture for the person who's presenting.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. If there's one PSA we can say, it's that. Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Well, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much. Yeah. Nice talking to you.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Rich for giving us a glimpse into his wonderful, wild world. Now, let's float away together on the final track from Synthetic Season 2. This is called Liminal. Music Buddy is brought to you by Morning Run Productions. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at Music Buddy Podcast. You can email me, Jane, at musicbuddy.ca if you want to get in touch old school style. And if you like what you hear, please tell your friends and family about the podcast. A little echo and reverb go a long way. In the meantime, stay hydrated, everyone.